Okay. Three, two, one.
Archiving started.
Good morning. Welcome to Polar Connect. We're excited to have another Polar Connect event with Mike League and the research team that has been down in Antarctica since August, late August, that is. So they've been there a while. They're going to be talking about the work that they've been doing under the sea ice and looking at marine worms. And they're really going to go into some of the data today and what it's been like for them over the last couple of months. And I think this might be one of our last live events with Mike and the team because I think they'll be heading home soon back to the States. So we're going to go over a few things before we turn it over to Mike and the team. The platform you're using today is called Horizon Wimba. The center of the screen should have changed. The content will be showing up in the center, and it should have changed to a slide that says Welcome to Wimba and showing you all the features that we have. When you get a chance to ask questions at the very end, or you will need to press the voice over IP button if you're talking through the computer. Hold that button down the entire time you're talking, and then you release it. You can also ask questions as we go along in the chat area. You've seen some chat probably already happening down there, but you just type it to everybody in the main room in the little white box and then hit enter, and then it will show up in the box above there. There's a list of participants in the bottom right, and as you go along, if you have a question that you want to ask live at the very end, or you want to put little happy faces or applaud the presenters, there's little buttons down below the list of participants' names that you can use. The little hand icon is like raising your hand, and it lets us know that you want to ask a question. And if you have any trouble as we go along, you can type a text message to myself or Allison York, who is really Sarah Crowley in our office, and we'll try to help you. Or you could go out, try clicking on the exit or lobby buttons above the ARCUS logo. This event will be archived. We'll post it on the website as well as send it out to all the participants. And I think today we have a manageable number of people that we can actually do a roll call. And this will give you an opportunity to check out your voice over IP. If you're on a phone, you can *6 to unmute your phone when we call it. We'll just go down the list of participants starting at the top, so it's alphabetical. And if you can't use your voice over IP, just type in who you are, where you are, and how many students or people are attending. So we'll start with Mr. Aceto's class. Go ahead. Maybe. Okay. Well, we'll move on. Mr. Aceto's class, they're from California, and I think they'll introduce how many students they have here. Do we have Wanda Blurton on? Joan Boyle? Maybe we won't do roll call. Sam Chrisman?
Joan Boyle's on here, though.
I know. People are probably dealing with their classes. Okay, so I'm going to change this a little bit. Okay. I'll let you guys introduce yourselves in the text, and I'm just going to tell, okay, somebody opened up their phone or their mic, and you need to either mute it. Thank you. *6 to mute your phone. Okay. I'll just let you guys introduce yourselves and tell the research team where you're from, because they don't have the participant list at this time, so they don't know where, what grades or who's calling in, and we'll just move on. So the next slide is about the Polar Trek program and why Mike League is down with the research team in Antarctica. He is down there as part of a professional development program that's funded by the National Science Foundation, and basically that just means we're giving teachers an opportunity to work with scientists and learn more about what is happening with science in the polar region. So they get to work with the science team, do lots of hands-on things, and then they come back to the classrooms and work with the students. We are funded like I said, with the National Science Foundation, and we've been doing this since 2010 on this particular grant and placing teachers both in the Arctic region as well as the Antarctic. With that, I'm going to actually turn this over to Mike. And Mike, we have your title slide up, and we're ready to go on here on our end.
Great. So hello, everyone, from McMurdo Station, Antarctica. I heard a little bit of the weather report from some of our groups following from Florida and California. Well, we've woken up here on Saturday morning. It's 7 a.m., and it's about 26 degrees below zero outside. So a little different here than some of your classrooms where you're located. If you'll go to the next slide, you'll see the research team that has been with us here at McMurdo for about the past 7 weeks, and this includes Dr. Adam Marsh from the University of Delaware, his two students, scientists Stephanie Guida and Anna Marie Pasqualoni. We've also been fortunate to be joined by Dr. Stacy Kim from Moss Landing Marine Lab in California. And then, of course, speaking to you right now is myself, pictured there on the right. And I am a school teacher in Delaware, usually teaching eighth grade science. This morning on our live Polar Connect event, we have everyone except Dr. Marsh, who has already returned to Delaware and brought back some of our live worm samples with him. And we just received word this morning that the worms have made it, so a successful collection and shipment back is always a good thing. We've been fortunate to be joined by some other traveling classroom groups. And if you go to the next slide, you'll see some of our special agents who have helped us out in the field and with some of our journal entries. On the left is Ms. W. She's generally found in Weymouth, Massachusetts with a group of kindergartners. In the upper right, diving underneath the ice, the first teddy bear to do so, Theodore, who joined us from a first grade class in Florida. And then in the lower right is Phil the Bear from our home state of Delaware, checking out some fish traps. And we actually just spoke with Phil's class this morning, having a great time. So it's been a really wonderful experience having such an outstanding research team. If you go to the next slide, you'll see how we got here to Antarctica. It took several planes, including the last one, which was a military C-17 airplane, which flew us from the country of New Zealand down to the ice. Traveling in a C-17 is unlike any experience you might have had traveling in a regular airplane, and that's because the inside is built not really for people, but for cargo. And to get a sense of what I mean, take a look at the next slide. This will show you the inside of the C-17 from the cockpit, and you can see all the people packed in very tightly, and then all the cargo way in the background. And we flew in this for about 6 hours to get from New Zealand here to McMurdo Station, and in some rather cold conditions. You can see that everyone's bundled up there because the airplane really isn't heated, and so you have to wear all your extreme cold weather gear, which we'll talk about later. To give you a sense of where we are in the world, if you go to the next slide, you'll see two maps. The one on the left will show you the view of the world from the bottom, and you can see the red arrow pointing to McMurdo Station. It's sort of in the little indent at the bottom of Antarctica, just below New Zealand. We're about 800 miles away from the South Pole, which is the southernmost point on our planet. And if we were to zoom in more on that McMurdo Station, you would see that we're actually located on a small island called Ross Island. And Ross Island looks on the map like it's surrounded by an ocean, but in truth, here in Antarctica, the ocean is frozen. In a lot of places. And so we can actually drive right off of our island onto the sea ice, and that's how we gain access to our dive sites. If you go to the next slide, if we were to zoom in on McMurdo Station even more, here's what it would look like on the ground. A lot of people think that we live in tents and we are constantly battling terrible conditions, but in reality, there's actually a small city here comprised of over 100 buildings. That house everything from fuel to carpenters to electricians, janitors, and the group that we're going to focus on this morning is scientists. And it's the science that occurs here that is the reason that we've come all this way. One thing that strikes you when you get off the plane in Antarctica is the beautiful scenery. If you go to the next slide, you'll see a little bit about what we're talking about. You can see for miles and miles here, the visibility through the air is incredible, and we are surrounded by beautiful scenes like this one. If you look way off in the distance, that large mountain on the left-hand side is actually Mount Erebus. It's the southernmost active volcano in the world, and it's located on Ross Island, the same place as McMurdo Station. In addition to the, sort of the beautiful landscape, we have seen some pretty amazing weather. And if you go to the next slide, this is on a very beautiful day, we get what are called nacreous clouds. And nacreous clouds form very high in the atmosphere and produce all these beautiful colors that you see, these sort of greens and teals and reds and oranges. In addition to the beautiful weather, we've had some not so nice days. And if you go to the next slide, you'll see a graph. One of the things I ask my students to do is to take data on the weather every day, including the temperature. And in this case, I've also plotted the wind chill. And for all the students, don't get too alarmed at all the data points. What I really want you to focus on is that red line. And the red line is 0 degrees Fahrenheit. And so anytime where you see the green or blue line below the red one, that means that that was a day where it felt to us like it was below zero. In fact, the coldest day that we've recorded was about 81 degrees below zero with the wind chill. And on a day when it's 80 degrees below zero, if you go outside with a cup of boiling water, you can see what happens on the next slide. When you throw it up into the air, no liquid water even hits the ground. Almost immediately, the water droplets freeze and form this sort of snow and cloud. And so before it even really gets out of the beaker, those water droplets are freezing. It's a pretty amazing thing to see. Now, to survive in conditions like this, human beings need to be dressed appropriately. And if you go to the next slide, you'll see an example of two of us. On the right, Mike is not dressed appropriately for 81 degrees outside, below zero. And so you can see that he's shivering and the heat energy is transferring away from his body very quickly. But Anna Marie, being the smart scientist that she is dressed appropriately. And the heat energy is transferring away from her less quickly because she's wearing some of her ECW. And to tell you a little bit more about ECW, here's Stephanie. And if you go to the next slide, she'll talk a little bit about the clothing that we wear.
Hello. When we get to the CDC in New Zealand, this is the Clothing Distribution Center. We walk inside and we find all of this clothing on the wall. We realize, wow, it really is going to be cold where we're going. So we have to wear a lot of layers. And the most important thing to stay warm is that you wear loose layers, something that can trap a lot of heat, warm air against your body. So we wear like puffy layers, maybe a down jacket. And then also on our feet, we use the same sort of idea. We have these boots called bunny boots, which you can see actually in this photo, in the right side of the photo. They're the white boots. And these keep your feet so warm when it's really cold out, even if you're standing on frozen ice. These keep a big pocket of air around your feet, and they have air compartments in them that keep your toes nice and toasty. And then, again, we just don't want any skin showing, so we'll cover up our face and wear hats, you know, all of the stuff that you do to stay warm, too. So I'm going to pass it back to Mike to tell you what we're actually doing here in Antarctica.
So on the next slide, you can see a list of all of our major accomplishments so far since we've been here. We've been drilling a lot of holes in the sea ice. I think at last count, we were at about 10 different places that we have been diving, and obviously multiple dives at each site. We've been doing a lot of scuba diving. Our divers have logged over 100 dives together. We've been collecting buckets and buckets of sediment and sorting through them to look for worms. And then we've been taking hundreds of underwater photos and hundreds of hours of underwater video, and we'll share some of that with you a little bit later on. In order to get to the water here in Antarctica, we got to get through that layer of ice. And I saw in the chat that somebody asked, how thick? Well, it varies. In some places, it can be 6 feet or less. In other places, it can be extremely thick. In fact, Stephanie and I drilled in one location where it was at least 18 feet thick. And we had to stop because our drill ran out of length and we didn't get to the bottom. To tell you a little bit more about drilling a hole and getting ready to dive, here's Anna Marie.
Okay, so in order to get our worms, which are at the bottom of the seafloor in the mud below the ice, we have to drill through the ice. And most of the places that we're drilling to collect these worms that we're researching are about 6 feet of ice. So what you get is you get this big tractor, and it pulls along this drill that's motorized. And if you look at these pictures on this slide, you can see this drill bit. And it's very, very big. I think it's about 3 feet in diameter. And it just goes in through the ice, and it creates a very, very clean hole that the divers with all of their dive gear can fit through. So then if you go to the next slide, you can see what happens after this big machine drills a hole through the ice. We have to clean it. So we use scoops, much like the ones, if any of you guys have a pool, these nets where you can pull out debris. But in our case, we're pulling out big chunks of ice. And then if you go to the next slide, you can see what we call a dive hut. It's basically just a wooden building that has a heater, and it has a hole at the bottom, which we pull right over the dive hole. And this building, being warmed, keeps the dive hole open, and it also makes a nice environment for the divers to go in and out of the water because it's much warmer than just being outside in the wind.
And so once we have drilled our hole and placed our dive hut, it's time to get ready to go diving. And here's Dr. Stacy Kim to tell you a little bit about all the equipment that we need. And if you can move to the next slide, you'll see some of that equipment.
So usually when we go diving, we are driving quite some ways away from the station, and so we want to be really careful to make sure that we remember to bring everything with us, and that's the most important thing that we do. We wear dry suits, and underneath the dry suits, we wear basically snowmobile suits, really puffy suits that trap a lot of air, like Stephanie was talking about, to help keep us warm. And then we have gloves that seal us off so that we're totally dry everywhere. The only part that it gets exposed is a little bit of your face. And we have normal scuba gear as well. We have our mask and our fins and hoods. And then because we're under ice and there's often not very much light, we carry flashlights with us as well. And if you look at the tank on the right, you can see that we have double regulators on there, which is an unusual thing for diving, and that's because the most common equipment failure is for one of the regulators to freeze up under the ice. And because we have a second one, we just switch out, turn off the air to our first regulator and our breathing off of our second regulator, and then because we no longer have a backup, that's the end of our dive. For those of you who are divers or are familiar with diving, you'll also see that we wear a regular backpack but no buoyancy compensator. And so we use our dry suits to keep plenty of air around us, but that's because we don't use a buoyancy compensator because there is no resting or swimming on the surface because you're under the ice, and that is the primary big difference between diving here and diving somewhere else. So we're very careful to bring all of our gear with us and plenty of extras, and then we head off in our piston buoy to get to our dive site.
So as Dr. Stacy Kim said, we have to travel to our dive sites, and there are a few modes of transportation that we can use in Antarctica. The four main types are by piston buoy. This is in the lower left, and you can see this is like a truck with big tracks instead of wheels. And then in the top left, you can see a vehicle that actually looks like a truck, and it is a truck, but instead of wheels, it has four smaller tracks. And the top right, you can see the snowmobile, and then in the bottom right, you can see a helicopter. So these are all tools that people use here to get around the ice and islands and all around Antarctica. In the next slide, you can see a closer up of my favorite mode of transportation. This is the piston buoy. Here you can see Theodore is driving me as a passenger. Kind of silly, right? In the next slide, you can see one of the reasons why it's so important that we have a big track vehicle. We're driving across all of these bumps on top of the snow, which is on top of the sea ice. So we're driving around over this frozen ocean covered with a, well, ranging from a couple feet of snow to no snow. But the snow can get pretty windblown and bumpy. These bumps in the snow are called sastrugi, and they make it really difficult to drive over the ice. It's very, very bumpy. So the track vehicle helps us get traction and actually make it across all of these bumps. In the next slide, you can see another reason why it's really important to have a large track vehicle. When you think about wheels versus tracks, the tracks are giving us a much larger surface area on the ice, and that puts a lot less pressure on the ice, so we're less likely to crack the ice or fall through a crack in the ice like you see in this photo. So when we're driving around, we're constantly looking for these cracks and making sure that we're not crossing one that's too big. So back to Mike for how we get ready to dive.
So after sometimes as much as an hour in our piston buoy driving over the surfaces that Stephanie described, we find our way to our dive hole and our dive hut. And the first item is to get prepared. We have to put on all the equipment that Dr. Kim talked about, and it takes some help. We need dive tenders and people who can help us put on our gloves, make sure all our straps are connected correctly. And then once we are all suited up, it's really just a question of sort of falling from the bottom of the dive hut into the water below, into that dive hole that we created. And to give you a sense of what that's like, the next slide shows you a picture of looking down the dive hole from above. And you can see a couple important features. First is what's called the downline. And I know somebody asked in the text chat, how do we find the hole? Well, this is one of the ways that we do that. We drop a line down with these black and white checkered flags and also flashing strobe lights. And that makes it very easy to find our way back to the dive hole when the dive is over. When we're done, we take off all our equipment underneath the ice and pass it back up to our dive tenders. And then once we have our fins off, we can climb up the ladder that you see there on the left-hand side. In fact, the visibility here is so good. The water is so clear that if you look really hard at the center of the dive hole, you'll see some very small white dots. Those are actually sea sponges on the ocean bottom below. And they're down probably about 100 feet. And so you can see that far down into this water. So the question is, why do all this? Why travel all this way and put on all this big, heavy gear and drill this hole in the ice? And the answer is it's because what you see below. And this is a shot of below the ice. You can see Mike with the ice above him. And then also on the floor, you can see all the sea stars and sea urchins, the bright colors. It's pretty interesting, the fact that Antarctica is a desert above the ice, not a lot of plants, no animals, not many, but below the ice, there's all this life. And so this is us diving on scuba, collecting some animals. And if you go to the next slide, in order to collect the worms, we dive on surface supply, which involves a helmet and a hose that pumps the air down to us. And it's this process that we've been helping scientists like Anne-Marie and Stephanie collect the worms that they need. And so we go down on surface supply and collect these buckets of sediment. And to tell you a little bit more about what we do with those buckets of sediment, here's Anne-Marie. And if you can move to the next slide, you'll see Anne-Marie and Steph in action sorting the buckets of mud.
Okay, so after they bring us these big buckets of mud to the surface, we go into our laboratory. And we do what's called sieving. I don't know if any of you have done this, but I'm sure you will in one of your science classes. What it means is to take one of these metal kind of trays that you see at the bottom left corner. And what that has at the bottom is a mesh metal bottom. And we put the mud that they collect from the bottom of the ocean on top of that and kind of shake it a little. And the stuff that falls through that mesh, we get rid of. But the worms are bigger than the holes in that mesh, and so they stay on the top. And that's how we pick them out. And if you go to the next slide, once we pick those worms out of the sieve, we put them in a petri dish because we have to make sure that the worms we're collecting are really the ones that we want. Because like Stacy said before in the chat window, there are more than 20 different worm species, and a lot of them, being so small, look very, very similar. So then we look at these worms under the microscope. And then if you go to the next slide, once we look at them under the microscope, we have our worm pools, let's say, our big groups of worms that we're actually going to do science on. So what our group is interested in is looking at how these worms are able to survive at such cold, cold conditions, because there are worms just like these that live in Delaware, let's say, where we're from, and in Florida. But how do these worms live in Antarctica? And so this slide basically shows you the concept of our experiment. So we have our two species of worms, which you can see at the top. The one on the left we call Capitella, and the one on the right we call Theophanes. And they live in the ocean, which is at minus 1.5 degrees Celsius, or just below 30 degrees Fahrenheit. And we put them in these trays filled with mud, and that's where they live. This basically is what we're using as their environment. Just like the seafloor, the mud's collected from the bottom of the ocean. Same thing, keep them at minus 1.5. But then we actually get into our experiment. And I don't know if any of your science classes have talked about this, but when you do an experiment, you have a control group and an experimental group. The control group is basically what's happening in the environment, what's the natural situation that's going on. And the experimental group is what you actually change in order to see if there's a difference. So the control would be keeping these worms at minus 1.5, which is what they're used to, whereas the experimental or changing group is moving these worms from what they're used to, and then this is a different group of worms, to something different. So we're moving them to plus 4 degrees Celsius. So we're comparing worms that are staying the same on the left to worms that are changing, which are on the right. And once we do that, once we put them in these two treatments, control and experimental, then we can take different measurements to see how they're responding.
And so in addition to the experiments with the marine worms, we've been working with Dr. Stacy Kim on some of her experimental work. And to tell you a little bit about that, here's Dr. Kim.
What I'm interested in is how these communities change over long periods of time. Excuse me. And I do that by coming back year after year and sampling the same communities. And this is very similar to some monitoring programs that you may have locally and that some of your classes may be involved in. So I try to look at the community as a whole, and it starts out from the very small, which is like the little worms, the Capitella and the Spiophanes, and we collect those in cores like the one that you can see me holding in the upper right-hand corner, which you can see is full of dirt and contains all of the little animals that are living there, the worms as well as crustaceans, which are little shrimp-like creatures, and mollusks, little snails, and little clams. And there's a core rack, which you can see on the left. So I take six replicate cores, as well as a couple of cores that give me physical parameters. So one for grain size, which is how big the pieces of dirt are that the animals are living in, and one for organic carbon, which is a measure of how much food is available for these animals. And when I bring those cores back into the lab, I then sieve them the same as Stephanie and Anna Marie do, but I'm not trying to get the animals live. I actually preserve them so that I can bring them back into the lab and sort them out to all the different species that are part of the community. And then there are larger animals within the community as well. And we look at those by taking photographs and by doing video. And so in the lower right-hand corner, you can see Mike with an underwater video camera, and he's doing a transect. And we're looking at the larger animals like sea stars and sea urchins and sponges and things that wouldn't be captured in a core as small as the ones you see in the other parts of the picture. Next slide, please. So this slide shows a typical picture of the seafloor, and you can see that there are a lot of larger animals. And this is part of a program that Mike and I have been developing to try and incorporate the research that we're doing down here with students back where you guys all are. So we take these photographs, and we're actually going to have students in classrooms analyzing the photos. So they'll be counting all of the sea stars and all of the urchins and all of the animals that they can see in each of these photos, and then comparing them between different sites and also over long time frames. So in the next slide, you can see a typical area where there aren't very many animals. So this is a slide that would be really easy for people to count. You can see that there's just a couple things. There's a sponge in the upper left-hand corner, and that's about it. But if you go to the following slide, you'll see a much more complicated area, an area where there's lots of different sponges, different species, and it would be much more of a challenge to do the analysis on. So you can see in the upper left, there's an anemone, there's another anemone in the center, and then just all kinds of different sponge species all over the place. So there's quite a variety of challenges when you go to actually analyze this data. And I'm going to hand it back over to Mike now.
So really what we're interested in, a key word to our research here, is the word adaptation. And adaptation can basically be one of three things. It could be a body structure that we see on an organism. For example, your thumb is a good adaptation that allows you to pick things up. So if scientists were studying humans, they would say, the thumb is a good body structure adaptation. It could be a behavior. That would be something that an organism does. For example, when you're cold, your body shivers, and your muscles are trying to produce heat energy to try to warm your body back up. That's a behavioral adaptation. It can also be a special skill or process, and this is what scientists like Anna Marie and Stephanie are interested in, looking at things in the cells of animals and how they respond to things like really cold temperatures or what happens if we change the temperature. So we're going to show you a few of the underwater organisms that we've seen through some photos, and we'll talk a little bit about their adaptations. So if you go to the next slide, you'll see a whole bunch of sea stars. These are called Odontaster validus, and they're covering the bottom pretty much in all of our dive sites. And one of the fascinating things about sea stars is if you flip them over, and this would be true of a sea star you might find where you live, if you live in Florida or in California, as well as sea stars down here. On the bottom, they're covered with thousands of these little tube feet that they can pump water into and out of. And when they pump water into it, the feet expand. And when they pump water out of it, the feet create little suction cups that allow them to climb on things like this rock. And not all sea stars are the same size or shape. Go to the next slide, you'll see a completely different sea star.
So you can see by looking at, by comparison with the size of the sea urchins in this photo, you can see how gigantic this sea star is. And this is one of the interesting things that happens with organisms in Antarctica. They often exhibit gigantism, where they're much, much larger than their temperate or tropical counterparts. And so we're always surprised when we go down and we see animals that are this large. And one of the reasons that they may be this large is because they grow so slowly down here that they grow for a very, very long time, and they just keep growing until they get absolutely gigantic.
On the next slide, you'll see another example of gigantism. This is a volcano sponge. And volcano sponges grow to be extremely large. In fact, if you're an elementary school student, it would be very easy for you to fit inside of that sea sponge. In fact, on a recent dive, I went over and stood up next to one of these sea sponges, and it was as tall as I was. That's 6 feet tall. So these sponges get to be very big, and as Stacy mentioned, scientists believe that these sponges could be quite old, sometimes decades or maybe 100 years. So pretty amazing. Another interesting adaptation of the sea sponge is on the next slide. If you take a look, this is a photo from inside the sea sponge, and you can see the intricate holes and fibers that exist on the inside. And I bet if you're a student in the class, you could probably guess what the sea sponge does with these. These work a lot like if you've ever made pasta before. You know that you boil the pasta in water and then dump the pot into a bowl with holes. And that's exactly like the sea sponge. The water goes through, but the pasta remains in the bowl. Just like the sea sponge, the water goes through it, but the microscopic little animals get stuck on the fibers. And that's what the sea sponge eats. Pretty amazing. If you go to the next slide, you'll see one of the worms that we've seen here on the bottom. This is called a feather duster worm, and it's got a couple of interesting adaptations. The feather duster worm uses those tentacles that it sticks up into the water column and grabs food particles. If you look very carefully, you can see the little hairs that cover those little tentacles. The other interesting thing is it builds its own little tube, and when a predator comes along, like a diver with a big hand, those worms can actually duck those tentacles back inside the tube for protection. We've seen lots of different types of worms. And if you go to the next slide, you'll see another type of worm called a flavigerator.
And these worms are absolutely great. They have all these golden spikes across their back, which makes them really glitter and look really beautiful underwater. And they're about the length of your hand. They're pretty big worms, again. And those golden spikes are a protective function. So, once again, they're not going to be very appetizing to things that might get stuck by all those stickery things sticking out. Because other than that, they have a nice, soft, luscious body that I think a lot of things would like to eat. And then if you go to the next slide, you can see yet another kind of worm.
These are Nemertian worms, and a lot of people see this photo and go, ew, they look gross, and that's exactly right. They're covered with a thick mucus that sort of protects them. That mucus has some chemical properties that make them not so nice to eat. And so we see these worms all over the bottom, and not a lot of stuff likes to eat them. If you go to the next slide, you'll see a sea spider. And this is another great example of gigantism. Sea spiders that might be found in the Atlantic or Pacific Ocean are usually quite small, probably too small for you to even see with your eyes. But here in Antarctica, they get quite large. I've seen many sea spiders on recent dives that are as big as my face and pretty tremendously huge. If you go to the next slide, you'll see another interesting organism that I bet you recognize.
And this is a jellyfish, and we see a lot of them up in the water column. And like those other filter feeders that Mike talked about earlier, the sponge and the feather duster worm, they're filtering, they're fishing in the water column. So they're looking for animals that are living up in the water and using their tentacles to actually sting and capture them and then pull them into their mouths. So we've been really lucky to see several of these beautiful jellyfish. They're absolutely fantastic. You can see how large they are in the next slide.
And again, this is another example of gigantism and a different species of jellyfish. If you go on our expedition webpage, we have a whole journal entry dedicated to this particular jellyfish. And to give you some sense of size, this one is probably a basketball size or bigger. Pretty amazing. And even though jellyfish seem to be sort of top predators, they are not immune to being eaten themselves. If you go to the next slide, this photograph shows an anemone actually eating one of those big jellyfish, and it's pretty amazing for us to see, but a common occurrence. We see that fairly frequently when the jellyfish get stuck by anemones and end up down the bottom. On the next slide, you'll see one of the species of fish using a behavioral adaptation. It's hiding inside a sponge, and that helps protect it from predators. And makes it so that it's difficult for predators to try to find them. On the next slide, you'll get a good sense of what the bottom looks like here. We've got anchor ice. The picture isn't actually fuzzy. That's actually ice forming down the bottom. But remember, the water here is so cold that it's actually at the freezing point for salt water. And we thought we'd just wrap up with a couple of animals that I know the students will recognize. I know that Alex Eilers is on the phone call today, so if you go to the next slide, Alex, we've seen many Weddell seals this year, and they are out and about. There are lots of cracks in the sea ice, and they're utilizing all of them. In fact, we went out yesterday, and if you go to the next slide, you can see what we witnessed. These are our seal pups, and we're just entering seal pup season. And so this little seal pup is covered with all the adaptations that Weddell seals have, covered in thick blubber, thick fur, and has whiskers for sensing fish around it. Alex, we'll just prepare you a little bit. Some Weddell seals have taken over some of our dive huts, and they smell terribly. So prepare yourself for some work with a smelly animal. If you go to the next slide, you'll see another sort of classic Antarctic animal. These are penguins, and we have two species of penguin here. On the left is the emperor penguin. It's the largest penguin in the world. It weighs about 100 pounds and stands about 4 feet tall. And on the right-hand side is the Adelie penguin. And this penguin is much smaller. Think more like the size of a football. And it sort of is comical. It waddles across the ice and slides on its belly. If you go to the next slide, you'll see a picture of emperor penguins. And somebody asked earlier if we'd seen any penguins. There's only been two penguin sightings around town, and those were both of emperor penguins. But we're trying really hard. Stephanie and Anna Marie are desperate to see some penguins before they leave, so we're working to make that happen. If you go to the next slide, we only have two slides left, and we're approaching the end of our expedition. And so just to give you a sense of everything that we've accomplished, we've collected thousands of worms. Anna Marie and Stephanie have begun their temperature experiments, which they explained a little bit about. We've logged over 100 dives underwater, collected thousands of photos, hundreds of minutes of underwater video. We posted 65 journals with over 500 photos, and we've had a chance to talk to a lot of students and teachers, which has been great, and the research team has been incredibly helpful, so I'm publicly thanking each and every one of them for all of that. And we've made a ton of new friends and some great memories. But the cool part about the expedition is, even though our field season is coming to an end, we're far from done. If you go to the next slide, coming up in the future, Anna Marie is going to stay behind and continue the temperature experiments. And then all the DNA that's been collected and sequenced and analyzed is going to go back to the lab in Delaware. So there'll be more journals and more Polar Connect events about the genetics work that's going to be done. We still have a lot of underwater photo and video to analyze with Stacy, and we're looking for classrooms and students who can help us in doing that. And we can't wait to get back to our family and friends and my classroom. So with that, I think we'll open it up for any questions. If classes still have time to spend with us, that would be great. You can either type your questions or you can ask them using the voiceover IP or your phone.
Yeah, this is Janet. Great presentation, you guys. So with questions, somebody's already got the idea, click on the little hand icon below your name so that we can call on you, and then that way everybody gets a chance to ask their question. So we'll go to Alan's class there in California. Go ahead.
I want to know if anybody's ever been attacked by an animal.
It was very hard to hear you. You need to talk slow. But your classroom, it's hard to hear, so you need to talk really clear and slowly into the mic, okay? Go ahead again.
I want to know if anybody's ever been attacked by an animal.
Okay, thank you.
Was that classifying animals?
Attacked by an animal.
Oh, okay. Actually, we're pretty lucky down here. A lot of the animals that we dive with are just more curious than anything else. We've seen a bunch of Weddell seals swim very close to some of the divers, but they're not very aggressive. If you've heard stories of Antarctic animals that have been aggressive to humans, a lot of them are out by the pack ice, which is about 60 miles or so away from us. And those would be animals like leopard seals or orcas. But we don't really have any of those in where we're diving yet. So no dangers yet, but a great question.
All right. Go ahead, Mrs. Eubanks.
Hi, we have Ethan here.
I just wanted to know, how do you choose your dive sites, and how long do the divers stay under?
Wow, two great questions, Ethan. So the first one is we choose our dive sites a lot of times based on places we've been. We were really fortunate that Dr. Kim and Dr. Marsh have a lot of experience here in Antarctica, so they know a lot of good places to look for animals that we're interested in. Sometimes, though, it's just a question of drilling a hole, going under the ice, and looking around and seeing what's there. So sometimes it's a little bit of a guess, and sometimes it's based on things that we know, places we've been before. The second question was how long we stay. Dr. Kim has a little bit more ability to withstand the cold, so she's usually under for about 50 minutes, but Mike is usually done in about 40 because I get really, really chilly under there.
Okay. Any more questions from Mrs. Eubank?
Yes. Hang on. We have India. Have you seen polar bears?
No. That's the wrong part of the world.
Hey, India. Great question, and I'm really glad you finally asked that because we've been here 7 weeks, and we haven't really gotten that question enough. So The only polar bears you'll find in Antarctica are the little stuffed teddy bear kind that people bring with them, because polar bears are actually found in the Arctic, which is the North Pole, and we're in the Antarctic. But while I'm on the topic, if you've ever seen a commercial that has polar bears and penguins, you now know that that's incorrect. The two animals don't exist in the same parts of the world, so they don't see each other. So great question, and thanks for finally asking that. After 7 weeks, we finally get a chance to answer it.
Okay. Let's move on to Mike LeBaron's class. Go ahead, Mike.
What are you planning to do with the information you're getting from the worms?
So from the worms, we're going to get a lot of genetic information. And really what Stephanie and Anne-Marie are trying to understand are the mechanisms for temperature adaptation. Now, at first glance, you think, that doesn't really have a lot of applications to other things. But if you understand how to make things adaptable to cold, you can use that information in a lot of industrial processes. Things like creating fuels from algae require certain enzymes that work at certain temperatures, and the information that they're getting can help with that. In sort of on another sense, a lot of this work is called epigenetics, and it has to do with mechanisms that work on the DNA. And there are a lot of human diseases that we think now might be sort of working on the same types of mechanisms. And if we can understand those in the worm, we can then maybe apply that to human beings and start to understand some diseases like maybe Parkinson's disease as an example. So great question.
Okay, another question from Mike's class.
How does the weather affect, like, how you guys work, and have you had any storms or anything?
So great question about the weather. We've had several days where we couldn't go outside onto the sea ice. We call those condition one, when it's either extremely cold or very blowing snow with limited visibility. Antarctica doesn't get a lot of snow, but it actually, what's here, blows around a fair bit in the strong winds. In fact, poor Stephanie was outside yesterday, and the wind was blowing so strongly that it ripped the sunglasses right off her face and sort of blew them away. And so in conditions like that, working out on the ice is a really difficult challenge, and it has not always been easy. So great question.
All right, before we go to the next classroom, there was a question posted to you, Mike, about what is your most favorite or most interesting thing you've done down there?
It's such a shame that I only can pick one. There's been so many great memories. I would say, that probably seeing the Weddell seals in action has been tremendous. We've had such a chance to see them in the water and swimming close to us. On one dive, I saw a Weddell seal actually like scratching its back on a rock, which was amazing, really very cool. And I'm sure my research team would disagree with me because there's been so many cool moments, but just amazing memories.
Okay, we're going to go to Lisa Wu. Go ahead, ask your question.
Hi, Michael. I wanted to say that I think we might have walked past each other on the beach at Lewis, Delaware from your area. But I wanted to ask if you have noticed when you've been diving about if there's a zonation that you noticed with the organisms. It's kind of hard to tell from the beautiful photographs of the individual transects, and I just wondered if you noticed any type of zonation when you're down there.
Well, Lisa, Dr. Stacy Kim just gave you and your class a huge thumbs up because you're exactly correct. There is a large zonation that occurs here under the ice, and in fact, you see sponges that tend to get distributed more towards the deeper depths. Some of the sponges that Stacy has been collecting, we've had to dive down as deep as we possibly can to try to get some of those. We think that some of the factors that influence that are food availability and then also icebergs, because icebergs will hit the land in the shallower depths, and that will cause some of the animals that live there to become disturbed and maybe even killed. And so we see lots of organisms moving in to break them down. And then down deeper, you see animals that are more established and maybe older. So definitely a strong zonation pattern in that, and you're exactly correct.
Lisa?
Great, thank you.
Do you have any more questions, Lisa?
Just one personal question here, which was, I know your camera in an underwater housing, and I was just curious as to what kind of camera it was.
So in our experience here, we would have to say, Lisa, that electronics and water don't always mix well. And we've had some really sad stories. And stay tuned for a journal entitled Bloopers, which will detail all of the things that have not gone so well. But Dr. Stacy Kim would tell you that it's an Olympus 5060 that she uses. And I know Dr. Adam Marsh has used his Nikon D70 in an underwater housing with much success.
Okay.
Thank you.
All right. So we'll go to Mrs. Eubanks' class. Go ahead.
Hi, I'm sorry they just left, but Jake did want to know what they were eating, so I told him I would make sure to ask. And we also wanted to thank Michael for answering so many questions for my students this summer. Fall.
So, Elizabeth, it's been a pleasure answering your students' questions. And as far as food, we eat a lot of different types of food. We have a cafeteria called the Galley here on station. And so there's always a wide variety. You can see in the picture there that some fresh baked bread. And then this was a sort of an Oriental food themed day. But we've had a lot of Mexican. Wednesday is a particular favorite of ours, cookie day. We have a lot of fresh baked cookies. And then also we snack a lot throughout the day. You need to keep your body fueled. So there's a lot of eating of chocolate and popcorn and peanut butter. And a whole variety of foods to keep our bodies fueled and producing heat energy.
Okay. So I don't know if there's anybody else that wants to ask their questions live. If so, just click on the little hand icon. There's been a lot of questions going on in the chat room, and thanks to Stacy and Anne-Marie and Stephanie for answering those. You guys are doing great. Anybody else want to ask a question live? Okay, go ahead, Lisa.
Just one more. I was skipped that with all the photos there that you don't mention anything about krill because we hear so much about it when, you know, I'm reading articles. And I just wondered if you've seen any krill when you've been out?
So, great question, Lisa, and has to do with part of the seasonal dynamics. We arrived sort of at the end of the Antarctic winter, and so the light was just beginning to become a major driving force. When we first arrived, there were 2 hours of daylight, and now there are over 20 hours of daylight every day. And so those plankton blooms that you've seen documented so well in a lot of, like, the BBC and different documentaries, those will occur a little later in the season for us where we're diving. And actually, in truth, once that happens, the diving becomes very different here. Instead of having crystal clear visibility, we have basically no visibility, like 3 feet. And we change from sort of exploring away from the hole to tethered diving. But a great question. And, yes, we will see krill, and it is a really important thing, and that big plankton bloom, but it'll come later in the season.
Thank you.
Okay. So we had a lot of we've had several classes signing off, and they're all saying thank you and everything. So I think we'll probably wrap up here as well. And thank you, Mike and Stacy and Stephanie and Anne-Marie for doing a great presentation, and to everybody for joining us. It was good.
We just want to say thanks to everyone who followed along, and thank you very much to Janet and Sarah and the ARCUS folks for making all of this possible.
Okay. Our pleasure. So we're going to stop the archive, but this will allow everybody else to say goodbye and hello and all that kind of stuff. Once
archive recording has been stopped.